Daddy, we're doing?
I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy. Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we are looking at the creative arts and its impact in society, education, and our culture. So I've got two amazing guests with me today, and I'll allow them to introduce themselves.
Hi, my name's Malaika Dixon, and I'm an interior designer and art and design educator. I've worked in education, creative education, for over 18 years and run my own interior design studio and my own creative consultancy for 2 years.
Awesome. My name is Tarek Alphonse. I'm a membership manager for the Ivors Academy. It's a trade body that represents songwriters, composers here in the UK. A bit like a union, we represent our members by campaigning on their behalf, providing them some resources to help with developing their craft. I've also recently won the Richard Anthony Scholarship, which allowed me to do a master's at the University of Westminster in music business management, which I'm very much enjoying. I also work as a governor at Mosbourne Community Academy.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you. I've got some very esteemed guests with me. I didn't even know you guys were doing all of these amazing things. So thank you, and welcome. So on today's episode, you know, I want to focus on the creative arts and the world of, you know, creatives, because I think one of the things that I've sort of been seeing over the last couple of years, 5-10 years, it seems to me that, like, within society and within education, like, there's a sort of, you know, demise in the sort of creative world. And I wanted, you know, to know, so from both of your experience, like, how is like the creative arts valued when you think about, you know, your respective roles? Like, how is the creative arts valued in those roles?
Okay, for me, when I started teaching, which is over 18 years ago, how I started, we had an art and design department and we had a design and technology department as well. And it was, you know, they worked together, and it was respected. Throughout my career, you've seen of the change of the government that actually the respect for art and design has diminished. And I think it's to do a lot with the EBAC, or IBAC, they call it, the change of curriculum. So, you know, math, science, English became so much more important, and the creative subjects have kind of just diminished since then. And now you'll find in some schools they don't even offer it.
Well,
they don't even offer it.
Like, no art, no...
Some don't. Or they'll just have art, but they won't have DT.
Yeah.
Or DT, and they won't have art. Whereas they, when I started, they had both. And we're talking just about state schools.
Yeah.
But when you go to, like, private schools, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to primary school. So in primary school, it's worse for state schools. They don't have a specialist teacher for arts at all. So you've got your primary school teacher, year four, let's say, and whatever she studied, it didn't matter. She would be given the art lessons and the DT lessons as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you compare that to private, they would have a specialist art teacher and a specialist DT teacher.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I think in my role as governor for Mosbourne, one thing that we have struggled to do is recruit. It's a state school. It's a very high achieving state school. It kind of competes with private schools. I think we actually beat Eton at rowing last year, which is quite... Yeah, I know some black boys from East London managed to beat the posh kids. But one thing that we struggle to do is recruit in the creative subjects for teachers, for head of learnings for there, because I think also it's down to the fact that it's so difficult to value, or it maybe is a bit more tricky to put the same metrics or value on art subjects in education as it is to put on STEM subjects. I think that's probably sometimes where you see a lot of shortcomings. It's very hard to put, like, a quantifiable number on how much value gained that a student will get from a drama class or a music class as you would do from a maths class or a science class. And I think we can see in music, generally speaking, more songwriters are people that look after at the Ivors are worse off in terms of their remuneration from streaming. And you could argue that the digitization of music, the fact that everyone can now make music and get it out there so easily, has made it a bit more democratic, but it kind of has also saturated the market and made it so hard to go from like the middle class of music to what is kind of upper echelons, I think.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And, you know, I want to touch on your point, first of all, Malaika, in terms of like the art and design and the sort of mindset, especially within education around that subject. I know one of the things that I recall when I was head of year, often if you wanted to take out a student for intervention or anything of that nature, mm-hmm. it was, make sure you don't touch, you know, these subjects. And they're looking at all of the subjects on the timetable. Oh, but you can take them out of art. You can take them out of design. You can take them out of music. Mm. It's that sense of, you know, devaluing like certain subjects because, like, it's okay. It gives that sense of it doesn't matter if they're not in that subject. You can take them out to have, you know, their meetings or if they need to see CAMS and whatever else. And I would often have teachers who would say to me, I've not seen this kid for 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, I've not seen him for 3 weeks. And it's not the same person that's taken them out. It's the fact that if they're a student that has, like, let's say they're a student that has, like, behavioural needs or social, emotional, mental health needs, and they need to have, like, interventions or meetings or whatever else, like, they're often being taken out of, you know, the same subjects, which again creates the sense of you know, the arts, music, etc., being devalued.
For a start, it's not seen as an academic subject. It's not held at the same esteem at all. And so
what do you mean by that? Are not all subjects academic subjects?
Of course they are. I totally agree. Yeah. But when you are in a school, they don't see it as academic. They see it as you draw a pretty picture. So a lot of the times you will get, you know, members of staff or SLT saying, okay, we have this child. They can't read. They can't write. Like, let's let them do art. And I'm saying, well, actually, that's not the right attitude. Do they want to take art? Because it is a lot of work. It's a lot of coursework. So that's the start. Yeah. You know, if they are English with an additional language or they don't think they're going to do well at maths or English or science, then art is the subject to put them in. That's the starting block. Of course it's academic. I would argue to the hills that it's academic. But within the structure of a school, it's at the bottom of the pile. And that's the one, you know, art is the one that you put the child in if...
That's why art had all the bad kids.
And so therefore,
the bad kids. I'm going to put it like that because
even I don't agree with that too. But you know,
because I'm thinking back now. There were certain people in my art class, and academically I was bright, but I was also creative. So I loved art, and I picked it for GCSEs. But then there were people that in my class. I was thinking, yeah, there's no way.
And they didn't want to be there.
Because you know, like, yeah, you didn't want to be there, but. It's such a shame hearing that because, as I said, I loved art. I got A for GCSE. I still have my GCSE art piece at home. And I know my wife's been wanting to get rid of it for time. But I say to her, listen, like, when I become someone and someone wants to, you know, buy this
piece of...
And someone wants to buy this piece of me. Because a teacher wanted to buy it when I was in school. It was like, oh, this is a great piece. I'll just give you £50 for it. And I was thinking, if you're going to give me £50 for this now, when you just think it's a great GCSE piece and, you know, you're being supportive, like, imagine what that could sort of turn to later on. But, yeah, like, art, drama, I love drama as well. And it's just a shame, you know, to hear that it's seen that way now.
I think it's, I agree. I think the fact that it's not looked at as, I guess, a core subject, more maybe as like enrichment, doesn't necessarily give it that clout that you would get for a master's. But I see there's, I think, and I think your example is a great example as to why there's so much value to having art subjects within the curriculum, because it adds so much else to that person's life. I think, like, I did a study for one of my papers in for university where I looked at how you could use music to reintegrate at-risk children back into education. And one of the points of research that I found was it was a great tool for helping children who had poor English skills or who English wasn't their second language to engage within the kind of school space, the kind of classroom space. It helped to generate great cognitive abilities, great social abilities. Because music is something, in a sense, it's a language that we all kind of speak, making beats, making rhythms. You don't necessarily need to speak English in a sense to do that. And it then helps someone to kind of transition into the classroom space.
I totally agree with that. Because you're being creative, you're communicating without words. And so it does give a space. And that's the same with art. But as you say, when you have a child that's being taken out and they do have an English as an additional language, or they struggle with certain things, them not being in the lesson, you can't give them the support in order for them to actually achieve in the subject.
And Tariq, do you know what? You make a good point about that, because I remember at my school, we had a studio. It wasn't just like the music room, but we had a studio where the boys would go, they'll make beats, they'll record, you know, everyone would MC. Like, they were doing tracks for people who saw school as, oh, you know, I don't want to be here. You're staying after school for an hour, 2 hours, to be in, like, the music studio with the music teacher who, when it's lesson time, oh, I don't want to do music, like, blah, blah, blah. But when it's
free time
to engage and, you know, really push, like, your creative mindset, you know, the kids love that. And... And you're right, it does something to, like, their creative juices, like their ability to, you know, to like listen to beats, these melodies, these rhythms, and how do you add the lyrics to it and the choruses and the bridge and all of, you know, these things. And that's why I feel like it's such an outlet for the youth, even till now. And and a contentious, you know, subject that I always talk about is about, you know, drill music. And, okay, you started. And this is just my point of view, if you look beyond, because I'm a fan of drill music, but I'm a fan of a lot of music, different genres, not just, you know, drill. I just love music in general. So I can hear, like, a drill music, and beyond the lyrics, I can be like, oh, you know what, this beat is mad. Like, this beat is crazy.
Yeah.
Also, the way this rapper flowed on the beat is crazy. Or the way you was able to do the 16 and you switched your whole flow to match the, you know, the different section of, like, it just opens the, you know, creative juices. And I think that's something that, like, we've lost a bit. Like, especially in schools, to, you know, allow them to do that. Yeah, so that was a good point.
Yeah, I think
that you raised.
I think, yeah, it definitely helps build on, like, social skills and entrepreneurial ability. Again, with Mosbourne, we've had to, I think a lot of schools in general have had to, like, reduce the teaching hours within the week. So, like, on Thursday and Friday, the school is only, like, a half day now, which if I was in school, that would have been a blessing. But, lucky for them. But one thing that we've had to do to help kind of counteract the fact that you've got then these kids out on the streets, maybe not necessarily doing things that are productive, is then making those spaces available. And like you say, the uptake, and then you see the output from it is fantastic. But again, Mosbourne is such a unique case because it's achieving so high, it can afford to do these things. Like, it can convert an old railway arch into an architect studio, so that kids in Hackney can learn about architecture at a very young age. If more schools, I think, were making those options available at a state level, then I think we'd value creativity more and, totally and we'd probably agree. Be in a better place as a society, I think, too, as well.
I actually think that is definitely what is needed. And a lot of the things that I've been looking at and thinking about for my kind of creative consultancy in terms of working with schools and giving like real life project examples so children get to experience it, really. Because it just then builds the self-esteem. It actually gives options and choices. Because a lot of the time, I think children think they're doing art, particularly just to have a downtime. They don't see it as a career path, something that they can go and get a career for. And giving them real life opportunities and seeing is what is necessary for them to say, okay, actually, everything we engage with is creative. And actually, the business world really, really like their, you know, their the people that come to work with them to have a creative background. Like one of my cousins, she works in HR and she was saying that was one of the things they look for because it shows that you can problem solve and that you think dynamically. You're a lateral thinker rather than a literal one. And actually, as I said before, private school, they know this. So they make sure that those opportunities are available for the children that they have.
Yeah.
So we need to look to do that for our children in state.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I wanted to ask as well, like within your respective fields, like when did you begin to realise, whether it's within the arts or within the music industry, that the creative arts was coming under threat? Because I know, Tariq, you mentioned earlier, I think you gave the example, like within the music industry, like for songwriters, because we've come to like the world or the age of like digitalization, like that's impacted the way that they're remunerated.
Yeah.
Like when within the music industry, and we'll come to the arts after, did people start to realize, actually, like this is going to be like an issue for us within the music industry, not just for songwriters, because I'm sure there's other like there's other sort of roles and other people within like the music industry that are being sort of impacted and like job losses or those sort of things.
It's a big question. It's a tough. I think the music industry probably has been disrupted and has had innovation for like the better part of like the last 100, 200 years, from it going from like religion to church, to patronage, to royal families, to like the recorded industry, all the way up to where we are now with streaming. But I think in more recent history, what's really highlighted kind of inequality was maybe the pandemic. I think when the pandemic came around, particularly in music, live music stopped, which at the time was probably one of the biggest sources of income for artists. And then with those artists, the people then that kind of feed off that community. What was then left was streaming primarily. And I think it really then highlighted the inequality in streaming.
How so?
So streaming, it's without trying to overcomplicate it, the way streaming is paid out is very unfair for artists within that middle to lower class, or if you're not signed to a major label.
I see.
I think we kind of talked about before the podcast started, there's like a kind of consumer assumption of how music works, which is you pay $9.99 a month, or whatever, $12.99 a month, and that $12.99 probably goes to the artists that you listen to. So if you listen to Beyonce the entire month, all your money were to go to Beyonce. But that's not how most models of streaming work. They kind of work on a old archaic model that was designed for physical distributions or physical units. And because of that, there's a lot of confusion and essentially works on market share. So where you're on a label that has a bigger share of the market, you're more inclined to get more of the monies. So a lot of the time, a lot of your money is actually just going to Taylor Swift and Drake, even if you're listening to just jazz or dancehall most of the time. And that really then exasperated that problem when there was no other income to help alleviate that issue during the pandemic. It's a lot more complex than I'm making it sound. Some of the complexities around it are the fact that there's kind of different streams of royalties. So there's like a royalty stream for the recording, the actual recording of the song. And there's also a royalty stream for the composition, so the creation, so the lyrics, the melodies, and people get paid different rates for it. And some people argue that those rates are just inequality, you know, unequal. I think what really made it so, I think with a lot of things, was the pandemic, was the fact that people had to then shut all the venues. They couldn't go on tour, they couldn't sell merch, they couldn't make other revenues from getting out there and publicizing themselves. And they were like, wow, like streaming makes, I think Snoop Dogg said he made something like 1 billion streams over the pandemic and only got paid $45,000, which is absolutely nuts. I bet to
that
you
that is though, so crazy, because the amount of music we were listening to during the pandemic, you had things like Verses and all of these things going on, and that's crazy.
The music industry, I think, has come to a point where it didn't progress quickly with the last change with technology. So we moved from having $9.99 to spend on records like a CD. So you'd have your new singles come out and you'd go and you'd buy that new single and it'd be a physical copy, and things were a lot more easier to administer, to one where you're now trying to figure out how long of a stream counts as a single unit. Is it 20 seconds of someone listening to that song? Is it the entire song? Is it the entire album? What if someone listens to two songs from one album and then three songs from another album? How did you break up that money? I think streaming moved a bit too fast for the music industry to keep up. And I see a similar thing happening with AI at the moment, but that's another topic, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely. How about in the arts, when did you start to sort of realise that it was under threat?
Are we talking about in education or just in industry?
You can answer whichever you feel sort of most comfortable answering.
Okay, so when it comes to education, I would say definitely the introduction of EBAC.
Yeah.
And that just gave a focus on, like you said, the core subjects, so your maths, your science, your English. And actually when they did the timetable in for that, for Key Stage 4, it was packed with those subjects. And so it meant that actually they couldn't take creative subjects. And that's kind of how it began to dwindle. Also, the kind of lack of money pumped into education anyway. Art and design is going to be at the bottom of the pile. That's why a lot of schools have closed down their departments, their creative departments, because they just don't have the money. And so they can't hire teachers, facilities, and that sort of thing. In terms of design, I think, you know, with COVID, it quietened down. But really and truly, for me, I haven't seen any difference, really, for me. But
so you taught secondary?
Yeah, a little bit of primary as well. So the school that I was at had a primary school and secondary.
So within the education sector,
mm-hmm.
when we're thinking about the arts, so at sort of college and A-level and university, like, is the impact of like the arts the same in terms of like
people going for it?
Yeah, and you may not know, because I'm not sure if you've got colleagues in that area.
No, I wouldn't really know. I wouldn't really know, to be honest. But I can't see that it would be that big, because you're still having children that go through the private sector. Some of them will go and study art history or other creative subjects, because they're privately funded. They didn't have to make any changes in regards to what they offer. Even if they did follow the EBAC, they still had the finance to ensure that they could offer that. Their days are longer as well, actually, private school. So
yeah, okay. Well, do you guys think like artists, musicians, and creatives are valued today in the same way that they were before?
I think with music, it's kind of on the point maybe I was making before, is that it's valued in a different way. Digitization has changed how we consume art, music in general. Like, the UK music industry annually makes over like £100 billion to contribute to the economy. So it's continuously growing, and the UK, like, music, sorry, that's the entertainment industry, and the UK music industry the recording industry is valued more at this point more than it probably was when we were booming in like the 70s or the 80s when things were really growing. But it's a whole different market. Like now that we aren't just making or pushing new music, a lot of that money is coming from pushing catalog. So like pushing people's old stuff. Again, it's back to the streaming. Now that you can pay $12.99 and not just access new artists, but every song ever written in time, you're now competing against music that's come way before, against your Michael Jacksons and your Beethovens and your Aerosmiths. And I think major labels have seen the value in just pushing catalog. It's a lot less costly to them operationally to develop an artist and then put them in the studio, write new hits, as opposed to just push the same stuff. So I don't think the consumer doesn't value it the same way. I think if anything, they value it more because they stream more than they've ever done before. They listen to more than they've ever done before. But maybe because we don't have a very good understanding of how it works, bit by bit, we don't value the artist or the people behind the artist.
Yeah. How about within the arts? Because I'm thinking, like, one of the things that I was conscious of is when I was doing art, it was always, you know, Van Gogh and all of these people from, like, how many years ago? And I'll be sitting there thinking, what you're telling me, like, in these 1990s, 2000, like, no artist is relevant enough for us to do something, you know, different. And I'm not sure whether that evolved over time and whether, like, you know, within education and within schools, like, there were artists who were current, whether it's local or UK or whatever, that, like, teachers would say, actually, you know what, I'm adding this person to the curriculum.
What I would say is there's always been artists and designers that reflect the room. It just always has been. But at the time, teachers didn't really look beyond Western art. Western art was the art that was respected and design that was respected. If you look now at the creative industry, you see a lot more diversity. And I think Black Lives Matter had a lot to do with that in terms of the change of curriculum. Even I was part of Lambeth's Raising the Game, which was kind of working on primary and secondary curriculum and diversifying it. So I worked with Lambeth on that. And there was a big drive for that. But even now, when you look, you've got lots of different artists that are out there, even like Travaris Strachan, who was at Hayward Gallery. His exhibit was just insane. There are so many. I have relatives that are artists and doing things now. Micheline Thomas was in Hayward as well. So, yeah, it's different now. And I think we need to push teachers within schools to make sure that they reflect in the classroom. They have to, because there's always been art everywhere. There's always been artists that reflect who's in a room. It's just we haven't always made sure that we reflect in the room. We need to start doing that.
No, that's important, definitely. I wanted to, before I move on to my next question, I wanted to go back to a point that you was making, Tariq, when you were talking about like the value, but within music. And this sort of links in with my next question. But when we talk about like the consumer and where we are now in this world of like technology and social media and whatever else, like you could have a TikTok influencer who makes a dance out of a song and that starts to trend and whatever else. And all of a sudden it's like, again, because it streams, the streams just keep going, keep going, keep going. Does that value the artist if them trending and them becoming popular is as a result of like a TikTok dance? Because if I was an artist, and it could be similar with, you know, like with like an art piece. If someone does like a reaction to like an art piece, that no one cared about, and all of a sudden people are going to view it and whatever else. Does that in a sense devalue the artist? Because it's like, oh, if it wasn't for TikTok, then no one would be listening, because I've had the music out, I've promoted it, I've done all of these things, and no one's listened to it. And now, you know, because of a TikTok dance, like, that's... And it might not even be TikTok dance. It might be Kaisa Knight doing a review of the song. And it's like, oh, Kaisa Knight's done a review of the song. He likes it. 1 million, 2 million. Like, and that's why you see now artists...
trying to engage with, like, these people.
They're trying to engage with them. Yeah. They don't even do like promo tours and you know, whatever else. It's like, I want to go on this streamer's thing and do a live.
Yeah.
That's how I'm promoting my album.
Yeah. 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 I think it's a very fair point. It's a very tough question. I think probably it's case by case, because I think it's the same way in saying that you could probably generate engagement that could help you if you're streaming by saying controversial things like certain people do on certain platforms. But you have to then think about what value are you then adding to yourself as a person, as a creator, as an artist. What are you then building your legacy to be? I think the point we were talking about before in terms of like artist development, like, there is so much, I think artist development right now is really under threat, because there's so little investment in that. And there's so much being pushed into just getting these quick wins, whether it be on TikTok or through these kind of viral moments on YouTube. I think more people will start to eventually get sick and tired of that way of marketing music or arts in general, and will look for what we used to really enjoy, which is authenticity, I think.
Mm.
I think there was a point where the UK had a really authentic sound that came from people being in youth clubs, being in spaces where they could express and kind of talk about their lived experience in a very honest way that you don't necessarily get on a social media in 30 seconds. And I think eventually we'll go back to that. I think we kind of are. You see, like, now, even people like DJ AG, who's kind of creating a whole new way of using something like TikTok to give a more authentic way of promoting artists, as opposed to just doing a simple dance. So yeah, I think as complex as your question is, my answer is probably as complex in that there's not a simple answer to it. I think, yeah, you could use those moments as much as you want to get virality, but watch the longevity in it.
Yeah. And this moves well into my next question. So in a world that sort of, you know, has this great focus on STEM, so like the sciences, technology and whatever else, and we're seeing, like, in society that this is something that's just like moving, like, everyone wants to, you know, invest in the next, you know, electrical vehicle, everyone wants to be part of the next, you know, the next, like, big app and whatever else, and even in schools, you know, it's the promotion of like STEM. You know, come and have a week at this university and get to know about STEM, or do this apprenticeship about STEM. Like, it's really sort of moved, you know, forward at a ridiculous pace. And I guess my question is, with like the promotion of STEM, like within education and across society, like where do the arts fit in? Like, where does music fit in? Where do the arts fit in?
I think there is definitely a lot of pressure for students, for young people to go down these paths of science, maths and English, because of maybe the promise that you get afterwards. Like, you get a more sustainable job, a more sustainable income. And maybe that's a lot of pressure that you get from parents as well, which is why I think a big part of making people understand the value or the different opportunities within music is also doing that through the parents. Another thing that we try to do at Mosbourne is when I go in and talk about, or I get people to come in and talk about the different things that they can do within the music industry, that's not being the artist or the A&R or the marketing person, wherever it be someone who works in business development, so going into new territories or looking for new pieces of technology to help integrate into how major labels work or where they want to represent themselves, or data analysts who like to work at places like Spotify to look at trends and how streams are working and how they can move into new markets. Like Spotify right now are really trying to break into a place like India, where people are still using YouTube as a primary way of streaming music. So they have their strategy is to offer it for a pound, essentially, as opposed to the $9.99 that we pay here. There's so much you can do if you have a academic brain like yourself, like you said at the start of the podcast, that you were very bright, but you had that creative side to you. You understood the creative industry. There's so much value that you could probably add because you could understand the business side of these things really well. So I think just because STEM is on the rise doesn't necessarily mean that the arts will necessarily suffer. Maybe it just means that it'll just evolve in a different way.
Yeah.
To be honest, I completely concur with that. I just worked with Hayward, actually, and Norwood School. They call it a takeover day. We did a takeover day for McLean Thomas and Linda Sterling.
Mm.
And one of the things that we... And basically what the takeover is that you have students that learn about the artist that's in the gallery, and then they teach other schools that come for the day and take them around. So they do, you know, they learn about curation, they learn to talk about the artist. But one of the big things that we did was kind of talk about all of the jobs that it takes to run Hayward Gallery itself, so that we were informing the young people about the range of different career paths that there are, not just being the artist, but like you said, the finance department, the marketing, all the different career paths that there are. So it just gives more opportunity, more thought process. I don't think that arts are going to be frozen up. We need it. Everything we engage with daily is that someone designed the sofa. We need designers. We just need designers to just not always be from middle class, upper class industry. You know, that world, they need to come from everywhere, really. Yeah. And so the takeover was brilliant for that, because it just meant that we could really kind of give a clear view of what you could do. The gallery needs so many different people to run it.
And that leads well into my next question as well, because one of the things that I'm always conscious about when I'm thinking about young people in schools or young people in society who have dreams and ambitions, it's always important to have others within your respective fields of interest who look like you, because not only does that motivate you, but it gives you something to aspire to when you see that young black man who's an architect, when you see the young black woman who has designed, this set at a studio or whatever else, and it just gives you that, motivation and aspiration. And I wanted to sort of get a sense of, what does representation look like within your respective fields? And is that something, that needs to be worked on, or is that something that currently you feel, is diverse and inclusive?
I think it's getting better. Definitely getting better. So there's a charity called United Design. So this is for interior. And what they do is they take... people of colour, black, brown, diverse, and they put them in on out of university, and then they put them into different studios, interior design studios. So they get work experience, and a lot of them have kind of been offered jobs. So just to kind of go back a little bit, for me, I was teaching maybe for 5 years. Then I went off and trained in interior design, and then I opted to go into industry. It was really cold out there. Like a lot of the time I was the only black woman in the room, and it was very difficult. Whereas now, coming into the industry, you've got United in Design, there's people that are doing things to make sure that the room looks different, that everybody gets opportunities. Are we there yet? No. But the representation is there. Definitely there.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the music industry has still got quite a long way to go. I think Black Lives in Music, which is another trade association within the music industry, did a report that said that essentially highlighted that there was zero black female CEOs within the entire music industry in the entire world. There are few black female executives, so people that are at director levels or at COO levels, maybe on the board, but no one was leading was leading the charge. So there's definitely a lot more we can be doing. I can say that there are things that are there or are hopefully there to start helping change that. There's an initiative called Power Up by PRS. I was fortunate to win the Richard Anthony Scholarship, which was set up by an executive who passed away, I think, in 2018. His name was Richard Anthony. He was a lawyer who was also a very loved person within the music industry, particularly within the black music industry. He was someone that you could always go to for legal advice. And I think without him, a lot of the grime artists, a lot of your Wretch Free Twos, your Wileys might have got into some very bad deals that they didn't want to. So much so that when he passed, I think Wretch actually released an album called Antwi, where he kind of talks about his relationship with Richard. Without that, the entire point of that foundation and that scholarship is to get people of color, black people within executive positions within the music industry to help address that imbalance. But there just needs to be a lot more of it, I think. I hope anyone who's won the scholarships, and myself and my 8 other scholars, I think we're all keen to make sure that's like something that we all do individually as well.
No, that's important. That's definitely important. And I know earlier there was mentions about like within the creative arts about there being a sort of like prioritization or favoritism towards like the elite, so towards like the upper classes. And that's something that I'm not too familiar with. And when I was researching, I was like, oh, like this is quite interesting, because I didn't see the arts as being something that was for like the elite or the wealthy. But then I started to reflect on, especially British TV, when you think about music, when you think about arts, it was like, you know, an elitist thing, you know, the opera and, you know, theatre and all of these things. So I wanted to sort of get an understanding of how does that look like within your respective fields, and what has been the impact of that, whether historically or now, in terms of the arts being, you know, an elitist field?
Yeah, I think in music, it's particularly something like classical music, it's always been very elitist, primarily down to how much instruments cost. For example, like a violin or a cello would cost you at least a few hundred pounds. And then you've got lessons on top of that, that will cost you quite a lot. And then if you look into, I guess, more of the business side of things, going to school, doing a master's like myself will cost you a few thousand pounds. Obviously there's student loans, but then when you come out of that, a lot of times you're expected to then work in internships or work for free, volunteer for 2-3 years before you go into a pay role. So like if you're coming from a more well-off family where you can rely on mum and dad to help sustain through that period, then you're more likely to not have to quit or have to try something else. I'd say that's probably how I see it within my industry.
It's exactly the same. Exactly the same.
Well,
that's exactly the same.
Yeah, that's...
That's the challenge.
Yeah, that is the challenge, isn't it?
And maybe I will say as a counter-argument, just because I'm in my research mind right now with uni and stuff, but again, technology has helped make things a lot more accessible. Now you can do a lot more of these courses and things online. You can learn things, actually, a lot of things through YouTube. And I think AI will even push that further, whether it be at the detriment or a benefit of music. There's things like, there's an AI technology right now called Landa, which helps to mix and master music to a studio level grade, as opposed to having to get someone to do it. Now, producers will not thank me for mentioning that, because it could really damage their market. But then that could help so many people in Sheffield or Runcore, who are bedroom producers and want to just put out a decent track enough to catch some attention, get to that level.
No, so it's a difficult one, isn't it? It's a difficult one to balance. It's a catch-22 because there will be people who will benefit and there will be people who will, you know, be impacted by that.
Mm.
With that, though, as well as that, there are, like, funding.
Mm.
There is funding. There are grants. There are... That's kind of been open up to me recently, where there's, you know, lists of places that you can go, not just the Arts Council to get funding for you to educate, to work on your craft. But again, it's the knowing, like you're saying, you've just put something out there. It's knowing all of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's being able to go to the right places, get the grants, get the funding. Recently, I went to someone's house in North London, and they had like a jazz set in their a really nice house, a jazz set, and all you had to do was pay a donation. But again, it's about knowing about these things in order to access that sort of opportunity or be privy to those things.
Yeah, definitely. And I wanted to ask as well, in terms of, like, when I think back to school in particular, art and drama allowed me to be creative. It allowed me to sort of come out my shell. It, you know, allowed me to sort of, like, build on my creative juices. And I think perhaps looking back now, I think definitely in terms of like my well-being, I think it definitely had, you know, a positive impact, because I just felt so comfortable when I was in those rooms. And I think I can look back and say the word I would use was like therapeutic. You know, it was like when I was locked in, you know, Miss would let you have, especially in art, Miss would let you have like your headphones in, like you're locked in, you're just working, and you won't even realise 2 hours has gone by. And drama, you know, big up Miss Waldron, I still keep in touch with her now. And that as well, you know, I was locked in, the self-expression and whatever else. When we're talking about the creative arts now, when we're talking about music, when we're talking about the arts and the fact that some schools don't even have it and that some schools can't even offer, you know, the opportunities, you know, like the Mossbournes can for students to engage with like the creative arts, even as an extracurricular activity, like what impact does that have on young people and students, especially around their ability to showcase their self-expression and the sort of therapeutic aspects of what music and the arts, you know, offer you?
I think, again, another great question. I was in a similar boat. I wasn't born here. I moved here from St. Lucia when I was like 10 years old. And one of the things that I was just blown away about this country is the vast options of art. You know, there's the theatre you could go to when you're up until like a certain age for a very cheap price, if not free. There's so many like youth clubs that had like small studio spaces at the time. I was going to a lot of places like Stratford Rex and birthdays that I wasn't really allowed to be in, but I got to see some great music coming up through it. And because of that, it's allowed me to be on this amazing pathway that I feel like is so much of me now, so much of my identity. But had I not had access to that within my education, I would dread to think where I would probably be right now, maybe, in terms of like career path, maybe in my confidence. A lot of the things that I've learned about speaking about, a lot of things I'm passionate about speaking about as well is all to do with the fact that I love art so much. So, I think it's a difficult thing to, a difficult future to have if there were no art for young people. But I think young people also, the one thing I really enjoy about working at Mossbourne is young people are so adaptable. Like that's probably one of the best things about being young, is because you're such in flux, you're able to just find new ways of being creative and do new things. So I think even if it wasn't offered in school, I'd like to think they'd probably find a way. Mm. It's just maybe not, might not be a very productive way. It might be a TikTok way where it's very commercialized, not very organic.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. I think I didn't grow up necessarily being taken to, I went to museums, but I wasn't taken to like galleries as such, really. But it just was in my veins. It's part of who I am. Like from a very young age, I would like cut up my clothes and make things. Mm. I just couldn't breathe without it, if I'm honest. So I agree with you. Mm. I think if it's in you, you're going to find a way. But what I would say is the path that I've taken, I wouldn't have taken if I knew more.
Mm.
And my point is I don't want really any other young person to have to go the route that I've gone.
Yeah.
Like, I want them to be informed. I want them to know. So I do really think that it needs to change. They will always be creative, but I want them to have, I want it to be an equal playing, that everybody has the same opportunities, that everybody has the same knowledge, know-how to achieve what they want to achieve.
I think that's such an interesting point, because if you were to become like a doctor or even a teacher, like the pathways, it's almost like a formula. It's very clear as to what you got to do. But yeah, I try to think.
I babbled, if you know what I mean. I became a teacher. I love teaching. I do. Like I think that's part of my identity. But my mum was a teacher and my dad was a teacher.
Mm.
So it was clear how to do that.
Yeah.
But both of them are academics. I'm academic too, creatively. But, you know, my dad was at AST at maths and my mum taught at university. Mm. And so, you know, even when I said I wanted to go to art school, they went crazy. But I was so determined that that was my route that I ended up having to do an extra A-level. Like they knew they had to compromise with me because I was going to do it anyway.
Mm.
So they made me do an extra A-level as well as the course that I wanted to take. But then there's going to be another child that doesn't have the confidence that I have to stand up to their parents and say, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even though I didn't have a route or know how I was going to get there.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I just think the knowledge needs, you know, knowledge is power.
Yeah.
That's it, you know.
And when we think, and as like educators or leaders within this space and, you know, even parents, like how do we keep arts alive, like within our young people and within, you know, our children, etc. Because we know about our experiences and what we had to go through, and it's ingrained in what we do. Mm. And I feel it's the same for me when I'm thinking about like the podcast, when I think about how I post like my content or whatever, like the creative juices are always, you know, flowing, and it's just, you know, within me. How do we pass it on to the youth and our children who maybe don't have the same opportunities as what we did growing up?
For me, that's kind of what my creative consultancy is about, is making sure that there's initiatives that can go out into state schools and share the knowledge, give opportunities and experiences to try and, you know, contribute to trying to create a level space of knowledge and access. In terms of at home, like I have three creatives, they all draw, they're all really creative. And so from a very young age, I took them to galleries. I think a lot of parents think, oh, it's supposed to be a quiet space. Don't know if I should take them there. But I do.
Yeah.
And they take their paper and they take their colouring pencils, and you see my children on the floor and they're drawing. We have to just expose them to it. You're not going to know if they love it, like it, loathe it, unless you expose them to it. I think too often as parents, we're worried about how the environment's going to respond to us, when really we want to know, we want to be thinking about how that environment's going to affect our children. Is it going to be good for them? How do we know what to expose them to, what to extend them on, what to develop them on, if we don't see what they're into?
Mm.
Rather than just the go-to things.
Definitely. And exposure. And with that exposure as well, thinking about example and the previous question that I asked about accessibility and, you know, like wealth, etc., is that a lot of young people won't have those experiences until they go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about like my first time going to the theatre and whatever else, it was with the school.
Mm-hmm.
Like my mum didn't, you know, necessarily, you know, take me even now, like to go theatre, some, unless like the tickets are, you know, like good prices, you'll be thinking, damn, like they're expensive.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, a lot of kids don't have that opportunity, so they can only access it when, you know, they're with a school, when, you know, schools get like, you know, whole school discount and whatever else. And I think it's important for, you know, maybe this is a parent hat on, it's important for maybe parents to be intentional with saying, actually, that money that I could have used to maybe go Fort Park or maybe do X, Y, and Z, that you can use it for these like mm-hmm. opportunities with like galleries, etc. Because I know there's a lot of galleries that do free exhibitions as well. Like mm-hmm. I've taken like, I don't even know how old my son was at the time. He might have been like 1.5, and there was like an exhibition at the Saatchi gallery, and I took him there. And these are the sort of things that I look out for. But I was just thinking about that from the point that you made.
Yeah, I think there's no way of like sugarcoating probably how just bad things are right now in society. We've gone through a decade, 15 years of austerity, and it's looking like it's not going to get any better the next 5-10 years. A lot of the things that were publicly subsidized, paid for by the government, have been slashed, like youth councils, and a lot of like school trips aren't affordable for schools anymore. So it's a difficult one. I think exposure definitely is the right way. I think, you know, being part of these things is how I kind of got how far I did it in probably the space that I did, was just being around art all the time, and you know, rather than doing other things that would have necessarily benefited me at all. But you're right, there are things like the National Gallery that is free. The National Theatre do like £5 tickets, rush tickets, I believe. And they don't always just do Shakespeare or old plays, they do new stuff as well.
Mm.
They did a show called The Barbershop, which was about barbershop culture. That was one of my favourite shows of all time.
Wow.
That was a great way for people, I think, to be integrated, or people that are from marginalised communities to kind of understand how theatre works, how it can be used to kind of represent culture. There was another one called Nine Night that was fantastic as well. With music, there are loads of initiatives that the major labels will put out, and major organisations will put out, as much as they can do anyway, maybe not as much as they used to, but to help develop the new generation. I think it is just about finding things, and I think our government probably could do a better job at centralising and pulling these things together. We've not had a proper culture secretary, I would say, for the last 10 years. A lot of the culture secretaries have been people who have had experience outside of the arts. I'd say maybe Lisa Nanny, the current culture secretary, is actually someone who studied art at school. I think she played the violin, or she played some sort of instrument. I think it's really important to have people like that in those positions of power, because they can really advocate for proper change.
Yeah, and I'm going to go into my final question, but I don't know if this is like naivety from me, but I didn't even know there was a culture
secretary. Yeah, there's I mean, most countries.
What's their role? Like, what do they?
Lisa Nandy's role is to look after the cultural development of arts within the UK, whether it be historic or new arts. I mean, the UK is a cultural capital. Like, we've made a lot of fantastic art over the years. We've been a leader in this. Maybe in the last like 10 years, we've been very bad at exporting our music in particular to the world. But historically, like, we've been at the forefront of most of it.
Okay.
And it's their job just to make sure we stay
at the forefront. Within that.
Yeah, like I say, it brings in 100 billion a year for the economy. It probably is like 3% of GDP. But that's still quite a significant amount for Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves.
No, that's amazing. Thank you for sharing. So the final question before we finish off, I wanted to ask, like, what's one piece of, like, music, art, or performance that has really, like, impacted you or, like, made a difference?
That's really difficult. Yeah. There's not necessarily one.
But you got to pick one.
Oh, one.
I think for me it was probably seeing J. Cole at the O2. That was probably like my first big concert. I think that's when I realized like this is the industry that I wanted to be. To have that space kind of dedicated to this kind of coliseum of art, dedicated to music. Everything there was designed to make sure this performance felt almost perfect, as close to a dream that we all shared at once. And there was like this whole host of people that had similar interests. I was like, this is really cool. I really want to learn more about this and how it kind of works and how it comes together and everything.
Mm. Okay, I'm going to say Chavera Strachan's exhibit of recent. That really blew my mind because he really kind of looked into all areas like science, history, stories. So it wasn't just your typical, how did he paint this? How was the, you know, what was, I really, really enjoyed how he kind of took us on a journey. You know, I remember I was in there and all of a sudden there was someone performing and singing. Mm. And that was part of the exhibit. It just blew my mind. So I'll say his, and that was at the Hayward Gallery, and that was last year, I think I went to see that. It was amazing.
That's amazing, yeah. And I think for me, like, I would encourage, like, the audience and anyone that's locked in just to sort of take that moment as well and just really reflect on, actually, you know, what music or what performance or what theatre show have I been to or what exhibition have I been to that's really, you know, stuck and impacted with me, because it reminds you and allows you to sort of reconnect with that importance and the power in which, you know, the arts have, you know, in our lives. So that's important.
Mm.
But that's, we come to the end of the episode. Thank you both for coming along and sharing your amazing insights. It's been a pleasure to have you both on, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been the Too Cool for School podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on our social media pages and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thank you.